Blog Talk Radio.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you brighten my day.
Around the world, played a lot of games. It's been the depth of my heart, you the one to blame. I'm looking deep into your eyes, I can see the future. Ain't no me without you, and that's a damn truth. You got me pouring out my heart in this fucking booth. And you're just like candy with a sweet tooth. A little bit of you, just wonders for the soul. The better half of me will never grow old.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you brighten my day.
A dark night like this, I really need your help. I'm lost without you. Come and save me, dear. My superwoman in my life, ain't no need to feel. The brightest thing in the world, let your little light shine. One of a kind, I'm really glad to say you're mine. You're the only one that keep the inner beast in line. My time will never be wasted with you. With you, it's always something to do.
You're my sunshine, you brighten my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you brighten my day.
Sunshine, you make everything better. Summer rays, ain't no more stormy weather. All mine, you the end to the story. Take it to church, make the people say glory. Seen a lot of women, dated quite a few. But I ain't never met nobody quite like you. So fine, gotta run to the altar. Told your mama I'ma marry her
daughter.
You're my
sunshine, you're riding my day. Cause you're all my soul fire, yeah, you riding my day. You're my sunshine.
Hi, everyone. You're listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. Today, the interview is with Mr. Major Taylor. Mr. Major Taylor lived in Cabrini Green. As you all know by now, Cabrini Green was the housing authority in Chicago, Illinois. Some call it the projects here in America. He's going to talk about his life experiences in Cabrini Green. How are you doing, Major Taylor?
I'm doing very well. How about you?
I'm doing good. I'm sorry about the other appointment.
Well, you know, things happen. I can understand that. And more than likely, they will be beyond your control. So we got it together this time so we can go full force ahead now.
Full force ahead. All right, Mr. Taylor, you lived in Cabrini Green.
Yes, I did.
Yes.
Lived and grew up there, matter of fact.
Lived and grew up there. All right.
I was born there in 1948. So, yeah, I grew up in, well, actually in the row houses and with the red projects.
Okay, so tell me, what was it like growing up there? I mean, you turned out phenomenally well. You're not a drug dealer. You haven't been to prison. So tell me, what is it about Cabrini Green that made it such a great place to live? And also tell everyone who will listen to this interview about how you turned out after living in Cabrini Green. What career choices did you make, and what have you did with your life since growing up in Cabrini Green?
Well, actually, I was born there in 1948, but it was the row houses that was all there. They didn't have red or white projects. And I think it really started then as a real, real small child, because a lot of the activities and things that took place in 9/11 or in the red projects really kind of stemmed. My dad was a person who was a community activist. And so we had quite a few others, but those that stood out was Miss McDonald, Mr. McCoy, Mr. Harris. Those people were the people that was in the row houses before the Red Projects 9/11 was erected. But I moved to 9/11 or the Rare Projects in 1957. And the basement, I think it started up in about 1959. But during the 1957 and 1959, the Projects was a place of, I guess, a place of great excitement, you know, because prior to the Rare Projects being there, that was pretty much a ghetto. And when they erected the Rare Projects and we started getting people from other sides of town, it got to be pretty exciting, and it was generally just a good place to be. You had a few more options as far as where to go to play and entertain yourself, but it was pretty well, and I was not quite a teenager at that time. And so as I progressed into my teenage years, I guess I was about the age of 12, my dad decided to open up a community-type situation down in 9/11 basement. So he went to CHA Housing Management and asked could he have one of the rooms down there that was actually a janitor storage room. And at that time, there was no gangs. There were a few tough guys or wanted to be tough, but actually no gang-type situation as it developed later on in Cabrini Green. So he talked to some of the guys, and he was asking them if he were to do what he was planning to do, would they support it? And those guys were kind of like a little bit of a, I guess, a bigger bully than the other guys in the neighborhood. And they were saying, yeah, Mr. Taylor, well, if you were to do that, we'd make sure things would be operated correctly. And actually, that's what he did. And it just took off into being the 9/11. Well, it started at the tots and teens. But I guess at one point in time, he decided the top part of it was a little bit more than he could handle. So he said, well, we're going to have to drop the top thing and we'll just become the 9/11 Teen Club. And that was the banner and the name that they went under at that time. I wasn't quite a teenager. I think I was about 12. And he was a fair and honest man. He would tell me many times, and actually, my friends, you guys are not teenagers, so you're not allowed to come down. So we had to make other alternatives as far as hanging out at Seward Park, Hudson Playground, and until we became teenagers. And quite a few of us decided to get in. Well, who actually ran the 9/11 thing was the teenagers. It wasn't necessarily my dad. We had the 9/11 Teen Club, but all the activities and all the things that were planned for us to do as teenagers really came to the 9/11 Teen Club. He would be there to tell us what we could do, what we were not allowed to do, and give us guidance as to how to run meetings. Actually, I think a lot of us did learn how to run and conduct a meeting using Robert Rules of Order. Nobody was familiar with that, but after we got together and he told us how that situation worked up, we stopped running the 9/11 Teen Club, and from there it just flourished out to being as to what it was.
Okay. In your opinion, what changed Cabrini Green? The drugs, the guns, and things like that. What changed Cabrini? And who were the people? I know you don't know names that wanted the Cabrini Green area.
Okay. Well, I left general school and I went to Cooley Upper Grade Center for my 6th, 7th, and 8th, and I graduated from there in 1963 into Cooley High School. During that period of time, there was not the White Projects. Mind you, it was the Row Houses, which was Francis Cabrini, then the Rare Projects, which also took on the name of Francis Cabrini. I think about in 59, 61, somewhere up in there. My memory don't serve me as well. They built the White Projects. But the White Projects came under the banner of William Green. And over the couple of years, then they combined them together, which made it Cabrini Green. And like I say, at that time I was going into high school, and by it being the White Projects coming in and was new to the Rare Projects, it starts setting up boundaries. The right father said their area, and we had our area. And I think the dividing line pretty much was Division Street. So if
why was it called the White Projects?
Because the buildings were white.
Okay. All right.
They were constructed white, and the red projects were constructed with the red bricks.
Okay.
So that's how they got their names. But it wasn't really to the point that it was guns and taking of lives and stuff. You know, you had your little fights, but, you know, the white projects had to go to Cooley as well as the red projects. So you mixed in kind of there, but red projects pretty much went to Wells High School, and the white projects pretty much went to Walnut High School. But the mixing high school was Cooley. And we mixed together in there. Well, you had your little confrontations there, but you got along, basically. But once you crossed the white projects, once they crossed over to the red projects, as far as the 9/11 basement or the 9/11 teen club, where most of the kids, teenagers in the projects came, there was a rule or whatever that it was a free zone. I mean, you had your little fights, but you didn't have it as bad as it got to be. But like I say, the 9/11 Teen Club was instrumental in a lot of keeping some of that gangland activity down. But as 63, 64, 65 started coming along, to me, myself, I think the Housing Authority, the city, realized that they probably had made a mistake by building a Cabrini Green project over there so close to what they called the Gold Coast. And, well, I don't know.
Why did they feel it was a mistake?
Because the property that the projects were being built on was expensive property. You know, once you pass... once you pass going east, once you pass Well Street and came up onto LaSalle Street, that was pretty much a no-go zone for black people. I mean, unless you were going that direction east to go to Oak Street Beach or North Avenue Street Beach, as far as any type of socializing, you did not do that. And you were pretty much harassed by the police or stopped by the police if you was not making a direct move toward the or leaving that area. If you wasn't going to the beach or something, you were known not to go. And so we were pretty much not able to experience that. But I think the people in Chicago or the Housing Authority people realized this is an expensive piece of land and we need to get it back.
Okay. You believe it was most of the people there were black?
Pretty much. Pretty much.
Racism. So,
you believe
that they started? Do you believe they started planting drugs? You believe they started planting drugs there in your experience?
Oh, definitely. Because right at the point in time when the old town on Well Street opened up, and I guess that was in the time of the hippie days, where they would love child and this, that, and the other. And there was a lot of people coming from other states, actually, coming to Chicago, because Chicago had got to the place where at the parks. And at that time, teenagers were calling themselves, well, we're going to hitchhike across the country. And they started bringing it initially. But then I think as the police and as the forces to be found out, there was a big profit to be made in that area. So a lot of police and a lot of other people who was influential in the neighborhood allowed the drugs and some, I think, supplied drugs and weapons into the Cabrini Green area.
Okay. All right, so that's what happened to Cabrini Green's greed and racism. That's my opinion. So what were the films that were filmed there? I know they tore down the housing authority, the housing projects in Cabrini Green in Chicago, Illinois. But you give a depiction of a great life there, of a good, decent life there, good, decent people.
Well, yeah, we was pretty much on a family situation, like I say.
I believe it was the people that destroyed Cabrini Green. The mayor or the alderman? Who
happened?
Do you believe the people lived that destroyed that? Was it the mayor? I mean, they stopped. Did they stop repairs on Cabrini Green?
Well, what happened was when Martin Luther King was assassinated and the riots and the burning down, a lot of the people that didn't live in the projects, they lived on the economy, west side, south side. They lost their houses due to the riot and the looting and the burning. So they had to get emergency housing for those people. A lot of people on the west or the south side of Chicago actually didn't really know there was a Cabrini Green area where black people stayed. They always thought Gold Coast was white people. But once they did the rioting and they had to find emergency housing, they moved a lot of people over into Cabrini Green. And a lot of the people, teenagers at that time, they were starting to become gang members. Like it was around a little bit after the Blackstone Rangers. Well, the Blackstone Rangers, when they started out on the south side, they were known as the Range Riders for the people who lived in the neighborhood. But as they progressed and got bigger, they became the Blackstone Rangers. But anyway, at that time, they moved a lot of the people over into the projects. And like you were alluding to, at that same era and time, the city was on the way of trying to get rid of Cabrini Green. And they stopped, like you said, they stopped giving services. They stopped fixing the elevators. They stopped repairing the apartments. The apartments of people left moved out. They left vacant, which they became occupied with the gangbangers. And they were using those type of things as a reason to tear down the projects at Cabrini. But being in the 9/11 Teen Club, we used to do a lot of meetings with community organizations. So one time, Adlai Stevenson, who was the senator at the time, he came to the 9/11 Teen Club. We had a little office upstairs in the building. And he had a schematic about the development of that area in Chicago. And it was called the Big 50. And I would imagine this was about in 1964. And what he told us, the 9/11 Teen Club, which consisted about maybe 12, 13 people and Mr. Taylor, that they were going to take this area back, and he was showing us the design for it. And so my dad, or Mr. Day, he would go to community meetings with the LAC, the Better Boys Club, and Vista Volunteer, and he would tell community people what he had seen and what was planned for that area. Of course, people just could not comprehend the idea of the projects being torn down. This is something they just built, so they're not going to never tear the projects down. But then what happened kind of shook them a little bit was when they tore the projects down over in St. Louis. Then they said, oh, yes, this is a possibility, but no, you know, you got George Dunn and we got different elected officials telling a lie about, no, they won't tear the projects down. But as time went on, they started seeing the neglect. That they took the electricians out. There was no plumbers there. There was no people to repair anything. And then they came in and said, well, you know, it's beyond repair. We're going to get rid of it.
So they deliberately did that. They deliberately, in your opinion, they deliberately stopped hiring electricians and plumbers and repairing and keeping up the Cabrini Green Housing Authority.
That was not only in Cabrini Green, that was in the projects all around Chicago that they stopped doing it. It was a planned thing. There's a book, I'm not trying to plug anybody, but there's a book called High Rise. And the book is about the beginning and the end of Cabrini Green which I was there to see that part of it. And it tells about the people that I don't know by name and the organization that participated in the downfall of the housing projects in Chicago. And, yeah, it was a planned situation. But the people was unaware. And I guess that would be mostly single parents home, there were mostly women, not men. There were no men to stand up and to argue or to fight for to keep Cabrini Green and the other projects, because it was a situation that if you were on aid or ADC or whatever, you could not have a man living in the household. You had to be a single lady with children, and they took advantage of that too. Because I guess, you know, these ladies did not have the power, and the men that would have been able to do it, they couldn't proclaim that they lived in the projects because it was against the law for them to do that due to the fact that I guess the federal government was pretty much supplying the ADC money.
Okay. All right. So, but in your opinion, the people themselves that lived in Cabrini Green did not contribute 100% to the downfall and destruction of the housing authority or the housing projects being torn down. Am I correct in your opinion?
In my opinion, not indirectly, because in the 63, 64, 65, the Vietnam War broke out. Cabrini Green became pretty much a ghost town as far as anybody over 18 years old. As a teenager, if you were 17, 18 years old, and you weren't actually in high school, or even if you were, but pretty much wasn't going to school, if you got caught doing misdemeanor things, such as pitching pennies, or either if you were stealing cars, they were before the Vietnam War, they would send you to St. Charles or the Audie home and something like that. But then when you got eligible to have to register for the draft, when you went before the judge would tell you join the military or go to prison. Of course, you know a lot of the guys said, well, I would rather join the military. But like I say, when they took those guys off the street, the younger guys coming up, they had nobody to mentor them, no guys to guide them, nobody to pattern after. And so Cabrini started turning the land of the jungle. Everybody was for themselves, and if you didn't get with the pack, you couldn't survive being alone because there were other packs. And then, like I say, we were having 2 and 3 funerals a day from Vietnam casualties. Johnson Funeral Home and Hart's Funeral Home, they were having sometimes 3 funerals a day, and like I said, the majority of the high school graduates or the teenagers was gone by the time we returned.
These men to die in war or go to prison?
Yes. Yes. Either you joined the military or you would go to, at that time it was Sheridan or Joliet. And like I say, I was not being drafted at that time, but I graduated from Cooley High School in the 67 year. The first summer of that year, I worked for an organization called CCUO, Chicago Committee on Urban Opportunity. During the summer program, I was an job coordinator. And I would help a younger kids in high school get NYC jobs. And it was really disheartening and hurtful to me because a lot of those kids were talking about their older brother or their cousin or whatever were being shipped back, being killed in Vietnam. And that was the thing. And I guess it did play a heavy psychological effect of the younger teenagers. And like I say, they started doing their thing, and there was the police department who was instrumental in some of it too, because the 18th district that was the police department in the Cabrini Green at that particular time was headed by a police chief called Brizak. Brizak We used to call the police the Bezak dogs because they were unleashed. They could do whatever they wanted to you, and there was no repercussions. And like I said, at this particular time, there was nobody hardly being organized to fight this type thing. We didn't know how to fight it. We didn't have people in the neighborhood. Most of the activists, like my dad, he was he only went to third grade grammar school. He was from Amory, Mississippi. But he would often tell us, and when we were in the basement, he'd stop the music, and he would often tell us, you know, just because you didn't get to graduate or you only went so far in high school or grammar school, whatever grade you went, that don't mean you quit learning. He said, I still learn, but I only went to third grade, but we didn't have a lot of people like that at that particular time.
Like your father?
No, we didn't. Well, we did have some, don't get me wrong, but I don't know. I'm still puzzled as to why the 9/11 basement was such an attraction to the teenagers. When right across the field, there was a place, a big youth building called the Lower North Center. And I myself personally felt most of the kids couldn't pay the fee. You had to pay a fee to get a car for the year to go to the Lower North Center. And they were pretty adamant about you getting in there. And they had a gym there. They had other activities up in there. But most of the kids could not pay the fee, and I guess the fee was maybe $2, which was a lot of money at the time. But it was the same situation where in the basement of 9/11, you had to buy, well, we wasn't as strict about doing it, but you had a card you would buy for a quarter. The card would last you all year. But now if you lost your card, you could get a new one for a dime. The money that we collected for the cost of whatever we did, we put the money into keeping the equipment up. We would go on little excursions to Star Rock or little areas. And once a month, we would give a birthday party down in the basement for everybody whose birthday was that month. Now, down in the, we would be in having a lot of problems because the police and the fire department would come down. And we had an open-door policy for those people. They were coming any time we were open, any time they wanted to go down there. And they would often get on us about we were having too many kids there. Sometimes you had to sign to go in, so we kept a logbook. Sometimes in that little area, we had up close to 200 kids in there. It was so crowded and packed down in the basement, even the walls would sweat.
Okay.
We'd have to mop the floor, but they started attacking that. Once they destroyed that camaraderie area where all the teenagers congregated, then
go ahead, keep talking.
It just pretty much got out of hand. There was no controlling the teenagers then, and then it started being zip guns were coming in, and it was different gangs were coming in, the German Disciples, Overstones.
Okay.
Wow.
All right. So the gang started coming in. What fields were being in Cabrini Green? Because I was told that Cooley High was filled there. The backdrop scenes that Cabrini Green for the backdrop scenes for the likes of like Good Time, Fox Series, Cooley High, Candyman 1 and 2, Heaven is a Playground, White Boys Down in the Delta, The Green Lantern, that's what Ms. Ron Simmons told me, Hoop Dreams, 70 Acres in Chicago, a documentary film about Cabrini Green, books about Cabrini Green, and also there's a coming feature film by Mr. Ron Simmons, the Olympic 1996 Olympic gold winner in the Olympics. So basically, Cabrini Green had a lot of great things about it, but you said the gangs started coming in.
Well, yes. Now, as the gang were coming in, those things you were mentioned, they were also taking place. And like I say, the police, they played an instrumental part in the gang uprising, because the police would do what they did with no no accountability to it. And the teenagers there were rebelling against it because even, I mean, you can only kick a dog so long before it starts standing up and fighting back. And like I said, behind the scenes, Mayor Daley and the city planners, they were doing their thing. And they were glad these things was happening as far as the teams and the projects. And I'm saying not only Cabrini Green, it took place in the Argyle Gardens and Stateway Gardens and the Ickes and all over Chicago. And but
how
I
did you turn out for living in Cabrini Green? What did you do with your life as an adult man?
Well, I got drafted in the military in 69. And me and the military didn't see eye to eye for a while. So me and them, I didn't stay like I should have. I went out without a picture. Well, as they call it, AWOL for maybe over a year or so. But anyway, I eventually went back and got through with it and did what I needed to do. And when I came back, my girlfriend was pregnant, and she was living in 1015, and I had a son. So I wasn't as much involved in that as I should have been because I was trying to, you know, raise my child and help my girlfriend and getting married at the time. I was about 25 years old. But anyway, I started working at a food manufacturing plant called Continental Food Service, well, Continental Coffee Company on Clyburn and Fullerton, and I got into food manufacturing, and that pretty much took me in. Took me through the rest of my life. I worked for NutraSweet. I also worked for Rich Products. And now even when I moved out here to Las Vegas 20 years ago, I worked for Ken Salad Dressing. And my particular job basically was mixing salad dressings and anything that you got to go with, along with a dinner other than the meat. I would make the waffle syrup, I'd make chocolate syrup, and then I also worked in an ice cream. I would make ice cream. So I was pretty much in the food manufacturing. And I did come to Cabrini Green, but I didn't necessarily stay as active as I did when I was a teenager. I used to be with the JYDC, Georgia Youth Development Corps. I was also instrumental in Vista Volunteer. And I was with the Better Boys Foundation. So I was pretty active as a teenager, but once I was 73, 74, I was released from the military. Other things took precedent over what I was doing there. And I pretty much, you know, stayed away. I did come over and help out a little bit, but not like I normally would have done.
They didn't mind tearing down Cabrini Green, did they?
Not at all. And, you know, it really hurt me. It hurt me personally because I seen the area before they built the projects. And you're talking about it was really a slum in a ghetto area. As a kid down in the row houses, sometimes walking up and down Huston or walking up in Oak Street or Larrabee Street before they developed the project, you would encounter dead dogs in the street. Actually, they didn't even have sidewalks. People made sidewalks out of pallets. And at that particular time, too, polio was really prevalent. And we had a lot of standing water because the city did not pave the streets. The streets had big potholes, and when they had the potholes, when it rained, it filled with water. By us being 8, 7, and 9, we would go and play in the water because we had no other, well, Huston Playground was there, but that was it. We could not go to an area called Sewell Park because that was pretty much white people. But anyway, I see the red projects rise and fall. I also seen the white projects rise and fall. And I was pretty hurt by that.
I was pretty hurt by that because racism played a large part in it. Okay. That's my understanding, that racism played a large part in it, and the police did too.
Well, actually, right now, I was there in Chicago about 3 weeks ago in the Cabrini Green area, and I was just driving around trying to orientate myself to some of the areas I used to hang out at and some of the places I used to be, which was very difficult, but something hit me. As we drove around and there were people outside, it was a nice day pretty much, I could count the amount of black people that I would see, that I saw on one hand. It was pretty much all white people area. And it was pretty much the way that they had built up, and it was a nice area, was letting you know you didn't have, well, it became the Gold Coast. It was first known that when we were there, the near north side.
Not so did they give those people vouchers, do you know, to live in those nice apartments and condos and things?
For the amount that they
just tore them down. When they tore them down, did they replace them with homes?
The amount that they displaced and the amount of vouchers was not equal by no means. A lot of those people had to move out on the west or south side into apartments with their brothers, sisters, that was buildings privately owned. And that was a big problem with that because if I'm owning, I had bought a building on the west side of Chicago and I was renting my upstairs to a tenant. And when they were tearing down the project, she, for three different times, she had to have somebody who was losing their place in the projects on the south side that they were tearing down. They would have to move it with her because they had no place out for the that they could afford to live in.
All
and
right.
That was a big thing, a big problem there, the housing. And, you know, the Section 8s and those type things, they were overwhelmed with trying to get Section 8 and the white, the racism. Martin Luther King put it one time, and he said it exactly right. He came because there was a march out in Cicero, Illinois, for open housing and fair housing and stuff. They attacked the man, they threw bricks, and they did things to him as they did their march. He said that Chicago was the most prejudiced place he had ever been. And it pretty much was. They were just, as I call them, sundown places. Cicero, Illinois, you damn near couldn't get caught in the daytime, and you really wasn't going to get caught out there at night. But Cicero, Illinois, was out there where the mayor of Chicago lived, Mayor Daley lived. But, yeah, it was a lot of racism that was involved in doing what they would do, what they did to the project. Because the other projects that was on the east side of Chicago that was close to the lake, they wanted that area. So they tore those projects down because they felt that the white people that was in the suburbs wanted to come back to the city. And
they
did.
All those people, and most of them were black. Displaced all them people and didn't give everybody vouchers to have a place to live.
No, they did not.
They rebuilt.
What we've seen, and my dad and Nana, because we would have to go to meetings with them downtown or meetings in the neighborhood. Actually, in the suburbs of Chicago, when it snowed, they didn't have the snow removal that the inner city had. So the white people in the suburbs wanted to come to the city. And they wanted the Chocolate City to go to the suburbs, which eventually is what is now. Most of the people that were living in the projects, they're out in the hillside, Oak Park, different areas, out of the inner part of the city. And the inner city have turned all white.
Okay. All right. I want to thank you for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler. The rise and fall of Cabrini Green, everyone. The Chicago housing projects, the white projects, the red apartments, the white apartments. Some people call it projects. When I lived in the projects, it was called projects here in this little area that I live in. They're still standing, though. White people and black live in them. All right, everyone. But I do know for a fact drugs were planted and guns. All right, but mostly drugs in these here. But now you've got some good people still living in the housing authority here and everywhere else. In some places they have torn down and destroyed the housing authority, the projects, where there were black families, good black people being raising children and families. So thank you, Mr. Major Taylor, for coming on Show Talk with Angela Butler.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed the conversation, and my hat is off to Ron Simmons, and actually you too. And I can't wait to see if we can get this thing across the finish line of the movie and the documentary that he's doing.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Mr. Ron,
you
have a good, great man.
And you have a good rest of the weekend.
You too, sir.
Sure. Bye-bye.
All right, everyone, you've been listening to Show Talk with Angela Butler. That was Mr. Major Taylor. He was discussing Cabrini-Green. I interviewed him for Mr. Ron Simmons on Show Talk with Angela Butler, the 1996 Olympic runner, and he has an entertainment company, among other things Mr. Ron Simmons has. He's a great businessman, well-respected. Thank you all.